Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. I wish your introduction would have been just a little bit longer. Not that you should be glorifying me, but I didn't quite finish my Green Mountain Hazelnut Coffee. And have you ever tasted that, folks? That is really good stuff. In fact, you don't even have to drink it. You can smell it across the room. I'm sorry. This sounds like, Mike is warning me, this sounds like a television advertisement. But it isn't, because I didn't use the word awesome or wow. And I don't use those two words. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, as Audrey said. We thank you, Mike and Lucy, for being here tonight to assist us with technical research, all kinds of other issues that folks don't even know go on behind the scenes of the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Our purpose here is to discuss news, issues, events, and developments, and it's always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We had a couple of those tonight about the guy that got handcuffed. We'll talk about him later. This show is dedicated to our police and court corrections, juvenile justice professionals at both the law enforcement state and the local level of government. We try to look inside what they do a little bit. Tonight we have a very special guest that we got off of Book TV. I mean, you are going to enjoy Mr. Peter Singer. I will introduce him a little bit later, but this guy's going to tell you stuff about computers and cybersecurity and computer security that you never know. It'll work for people at all levels. And as they advertise him, he goes in this presentation and in his book A through Z about this business of cybersecurity. There's some things there you're going to learn that there's some myths associated to it, and there's some overreaction to it, to the whole cyber threat that he will explain very well. And he's a natural-born explainer. I think you'll enjoy that. So anyway, that's our show for tonight. We'll listen to Peter Singer talk to us about cybersecurity and cyber-terrorism type of things. We have a call number you can call in if you want to, 347-996-5983. 347-996-5983. This is a long presentation tonight, so I kind of want to move along pretty quick and start Peter's presentation rather rapidly, because he's really good. We do need a blonde joke, though, don't we? Of course we do. We always need a blonde joke. And I thought this was a good one. There once was a magic mirror which would kill you if you lied to it. One day a brunette was doing her makeup and said to herself in front of the mirror, "I think I'm the smartest woman ever." She immediately dropped dead. The next day a redhead was doing her hair and said to herself, "I think I'm the prettiest woman alive." She immediately dropped dead. Finally, the following day, a blonde was flossing her teeth. She stopped and said to herself, "I think," and she immediately dropped dead. That's unfair. Blondes do think, but it's a blonde joke. Everybody knows we do that. Ladies and gentlemen, given this era when crime is down substantially over the years in our city that I live in, crime statistics, don't get me started. I wrote that section in eight versions of Introduction to Criminal Justice published by McGraw-Hill and co-authored with Dr. Robert Boom. But they said our crime rate went down in a year. Last year and the year before, 60%. Quite frankly, that's the largest crime drop I've ever heard of in history, unless you have a town of two people and one crime and, you know, that sort of thing. But anyway, that's what they said. But we do want to play the Ohio Coalition's public service announcement against firearms.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you, Ohio Coalition. But we had a woman here this past week in this area that I live in. A guy broke in with a knife, and she pulled out a firearm, and he took off. How about that? I think that works a lot of places here in the United States. Well, here's our green tip for the night, ladies and gentlemen. We're not going to go to Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. But what we are going to do is take a look at this exciting green tip. I think this is wonderful. This just came out. It's a study by the United States federal government's Department of Agriculture. And they said that 14% of garbage that's dumped into landfills was this. Nearly a third of it was 430 billion pounds of food produced by Americans to eat, and it's wasted. A potential catastrophe for landfills and a wake-up call to officials scrambling to feed the hungry, according to a stunning report by our Department of Agriculture. It's a long article. I won't go through all this. But they revealed that in 2010, 31% or 133 billion pounds, I wonder how they weighed it if it's already gone hollow, of food produced for Americans to eat was wasted. It either molded or improperly cooked, suffered natural shrinkage due to moisture loss or because people became disinterested in what they purchased. I don't know. Sometimes I do that. You know, something's like 4 months old. I think, well, maybe I shouldn't eat it. Okay, but in 2010, 133 billion pounds of food at the retail and consumer levels in the U.S. went uneaten. Isn't that incredible? And think of that, what that's causing the planet to dump all that stuff. So that is our green tip for tonight, and I think we should appreciate that tip brought to us by our federal Department of Agriculture. And I think to the point that we should actually give, I was going to give them some applause and laughter, but no, I won't do that. So anyway, we do have that to know that we're wasting a lot of food. So I guess we should, now what should we do, Mike? Should we eat more? No, if we eat more, then we're heavier. I almost use the word fat. That's offensive now, isn't it? Then we eat more, then we get heavier, and then we have to use more energy and breathe more to reduce the fat. So, boy, I tell you, it's complicated. We need to talk to that great accountant up in the sky that's keeping the books on all this to tell us what is really warming our planet. And I guess your experience is global warming, right? I had lunch with a gentleman here today, a scholar, and he drank four or five glasses of iced tea because he was worried about global warming. I think the outside temperature right outside the window where we were eating was about 9 degrees, or maybe 19 degrees, something like that. But no, don't let that fool you. We do have global warming. It is out there, and Al Gore can confirm it. go confirm it whatever way you want to go. So that's our burn hook, our green tip. Let's take a look at some good old-fashioned criminal justice news. And there's some good ones on here tonight. We have a gentleman on death row in Ohio. And a man on death row for killing of a Cleveland police officer has been found guilty of a rape in 1994. And they traced him by finding DNA evidence, and it sort of matched up on him. We sort of overdo the DNA thing, but so a lot of times it worked. But a rape kit matched him up with a crime that was 20 years ago. So, and Brian had already been convicted in four other rape cases. But he was out, and he got out, he's out, and he's on death row for shooting a police officer, Officer Wayne Leon, in Cleveland, Ohio. He shot the officer in the face during a traffic stop. And see, he was sentenced to death in 2000, and the shooting was a long time ago. And he's still alive. Can you believe it? I can guarantee you in the state of Oklahoma they would have wished him well and said goodbye within a year or 18 months after all the appeals were done. But this character, an absolute zip, has been around all this time. He's raped all these women. And now he still hasn't been executed for killing this police officer. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. This is a good story. A third person's been arrested in relation to driveway robberies in Dallas. Those have been very popular. In fact, this article, I won't go into detail, talks about how these things are all over Dallas. They're north, they're south, they're east, they're west, but these are driveway robberies. They wait for you to show up a robbery. They usually wear a mask on their face, and then they pull a gun on you or something and steal your purse, your wallet, sometimes take your car, that type of thing. During one of these guys' arrests, it was found he was already on parole for robbery. Isn't that interesting? But anyway, this woman, Charles Hunt and Santana Andrews, I think maybe she even drove the, she's charged with aggravated robbery. But I knew Dallas police officers that used to sit in the driveways of usually very wealthy people and make $30 and $40 an hour, and sit there from like 9 at night until, 5 o'clock in the morning doing extra duty. Anyway, that's something. Oh, we had an interesting appeals court decision here not too long ago. We found out that a California appeals court said it's legal for drivers to read a map on their handheld cell phones while being behind the wheel of the car. And California, I guess, says you can't use your phone, but I guess you can look for maps on your cell phone. So how do we really know? The judge says that the law prohibiting people from talking on their cell phones without a hands-free device doesn't apply to looking at maps on cell phones. I wonder what else you can look at and make sure it's all right. I don't even want to think about it. But boy, technology's done something to us, hasn't it? As a matter of fact, did you see this story that we now have? I'm going to go down to that one right now, Audrey, if you don't mind. We all know that these smartphones are zapping our free time, our sleep. They're ruining, I won't mention it, our lives, certain kinds of our lives, our types of life. He said, but guess what else it's doing? It is actually causing tech neck. Yes, getting a line, a wrinkle across our neck. A new wrinkle appears around the neck, and it's not helping our backs either. So now we're going to have, I guess, the dermatologists and people will be happy because now they'll have something else to work on if you have tech neck. So check yourself out in the mirror and see if you have tech neck. I thought tech neck. That is something. It's a long article, and I'm going to let Peter Singer talk about some of this, but our commander of our United States military says we're not ready for cyber warfare. Guess what? Peter Singer will tell you maybe we don't need to get ready for it because all this stuff about knocking down the electric grid and all this stuff, it's never happened once, ever. So we'll let him talk about that in real real good detail. How would you like to get in and out of your house or your apartment building by just showing your face? We have a Building B at Knickerbocker Village. This is in New York City. Your face will do just fine courtesy of a new biometric security system. Here's how it works. The camera takes 5 pictures of each resident's face. One is selected, then another. Info about the resident are stored in the database. Once a tenant tries to get through the building security door, a high-tech scanner reads their face. If the system recognizes the face, the door is unlocked. So think of the complications. I won't elaborate, but think of the complications that could cause. I mean, okay, I fell down in a football game and I injured my face and didn't come out exactly right, or I, you know, who knows, some people don't look the same after they're drunk, right? Their face could look different. So this is the brainchild of Israeli General Aharon Farkash, who says it strikes the right balance between safety and simplicity. What's wrong with keys and, I guess, cards to get in there? You won't need that now. I guess landlords might be happy about this, but I think they're probably going to get more calls about this than anything. We'll have to see how that actually turns out. You read the one about the student in Montgomery County in Tennessee that was suspended after school officials found a knife inside his father's car. He drove his father's car. He should be spending time through college and scholarship applications this year. Instead, he's working, and if he'll even be able to graduate after what hundreds of people are calling an overreaction. He drives, he's a senior at Northeast High School. He drives his father to school, and during a random car lockdown, his car was chosen to be searched. And inside, guess what they found? A fishing knife. Guess what his father does for a living? His father is a fisherman. And so his father had usually lots of fishing knives, and one of these was left in the car. So this guy is expelled. He faces weapon charges in the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office. Can the Sheriff's Department just say, let's exercise some discretion here? What's the intent? I mean, who knows? But, you know, and if you're going to carry a gun, I'm not sure. I mean, a weapon, I'm not sure. A fishing knife is the last answer, is it? I mean, never bring a fishing knife to a gunfight. But anyway, I thought that was interesting that we still have police agencies kind of overreacting to this sort of stuff. I'm going to keep this one to next week. There's a good story in there about a federal study done about Border Patrol agents and their response to being attacked with rocks and stopping cars. They'll shoot at cars because they're standing in front of them as the car is trying to take off. And the head of the agency is saying, well, maybe we need to look at this. I think if a car is coming from me, even if I stepped out in front of them to stop them, and the car speeds up and it won't stop, maybe a bullet's the appropriate thing. I don't know. I try to get out of the way, too. But then they throw rocks. In fact, they've had people injured. When I was down on the border, I had heard about that from the Minutemen. They throw these big rocks at you over the fence, illegal immigrants, soon to be legal probably here in the United States under who knows how many names. That's good. I think we talked about this last week, that fatal car crashes by marijuana smokers are up 300% over the last decade. Just wait and see what's going to happen with all these states turning to some form of legal marijuana. We'll have to see what happens. Well, give me a minute. We're going to set this up, and we're going to listen to Peter Singer, and he is going to talk to us make a presentation about cybersecurity and cyber warfare, what everyone needs to know. And you know what? When he says that, it's not an overstatement. It is things we need to know from a number of standpoints. And he's a senior fellow and director of the Center for the 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution. He contributes to popular science. He's written 3 books that we know of, Corporate Warriors, Children at War, and Wired for War. And you can visit his site at cybersecuritybook.com and get more information about that. So hold on here and we'll listen to Peter Singer. I think you'll really enjoy this one.
Thank you. I want to thank the deans at Stevens for helping to host this, and to John in particular, both for organizing it and also for the really kind introduction. So I'm old enough that I remember the very first time I ever saw and then used a computer. My dad took me to a science center in North Carolina at the age of 7, where I learned how to program this amazing device to design a smiley face out of a series of letter M's. And then it printed out on one of those old spool printers with the perforated paper on the side of it. That was my first experience with computers. Now, since then, the centrality of computers to my life, but all our lives, it's almost impossible to fathom. For example, we live in a world where every year over 40 trillion emails are sent. The first web page was made in 1991. There's now more than 30 trillion individual web pages out there. Moreover, the internet's no longer about compiling and sharing information. It's also emerging to have an impact on the world beyond the online domain through the so-called Internet of Things. For example, Cisco estimates that over the next 5 years, there'll be more than 40 billion Internet-enabled devices coming online, everything from refrigerators to cars to thermostats. Google just paid a couple billion dollars for a smart thermostat business, to smart power grids, all linking together. What that means is that domains that range from communication to commerce to critical infrastructure to conflict, 98% of U.S. military communications run over the civilian-owned and operated. Thank you. I want to thank the deans at Stevens for helping to host this, and to John in particular, both for organizing it and also for the really kind introduction. So I'm old enough that I remember the very first time I ever saw and then used examples of cyber war art. So it's going to play for you. And the point, I'm not going to speak directly. It's going to play behind me. And this is for a couple things. One is to visually drive home that story of cyber insecurity that's out there. Another is the fact that there have been studies that have found that people are 60% more likely to retain what you're saying in a speech if they're looking at something at the same time. It actually doesn't have to link what the person is saying. This is one of those weird ways that our human brain works. And that actually connects back to a broader discussion in the book and in the talk that I'll give, is we need to recognize the human side of this, all the strange little foibles that we bring to this. So hopefully the technology will work with us and that we haven't been hacked in the interim. And all right, here we go. So to move on, let's pull back on all of this. Why a book about cybersecurity and cyber war, and why now? For me, it's best encapsulated by two quotes. The first is from President Obama, who declares that cybersecurity risks pose, quote, the most serious economic and national security challenges of the 21st century. The second quote is from the former CIA director, who said, quote, rarely has something been so important and so talked about with less and less clarity and less apparent understanding. So that cross between something that is incredibly important but less and less understanding, again, we can see it in all sorts of different ways and all sorts of different fields. For example, 70% of business executives, not 70% of CTOs or CSOs, but 70% of executives in general have made some kind of cybersecurity decision for their company, despite the fact that no major business management program teaches it as part of your normal responsibilities. That same gap happens at the schools we teach our journalists, our lawyers, our diplomats, even folks in the military. The book is also filled with all sorts of strange, funny, but in a certain way, kind of sad anecdotes that carry this gap home, particularly in the senior leadership. For example, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, the civilian agency in the U.S. ostensibly in charge of cybersecurity, she talked to us about how she hadn't used email. In fact, hadn't used social media for over a decade, not because she didn't think it was secure, but because she just didn't think it was useful. Or the Supreme Court justice who talked about how they hadn't yet gotten around to email. That was their quote, hadn't yet gotten around to it. They'll eventually. Now, again, in the upcoming year, they'll decide cases that relate to everything from net neutrality to the constitutionality of some of the NSA activities. But in their own world, they just haven't yet gotten around. This problem is not just an American problem. We saw the same thing in meetings with officials from China, Great Britain, France, UAE. For example, the lead civilian official, the equivalent of a cybersecurity czar in Australia, had never even heard of Tor, a critical technology in this space. Don't worry, if you haven't either, as John said, maybe buy the book. But the point is you have this gap among people with great responsibility. And the result is that cybersecurity is an issue that is as crucial at a personal level to areas that you care about, from your bank account to your personal privacy, to it's shaping the future of world politics itself. And in turn, issues in world politics are connecting back to the personal level when you look at questions of privacy, like we've seen in the Snowden NSA affair. But it's been treated as a domain only for what I jokingly call the it crowd, the IT folks. The problem, the challenge, is that the technical community understands the workings of the hardware and the software, but it doesn't deal well with the wetware, the human side, all the ways that it ripples out beyond. And so it often looks at these issues through a very specific lens and often fails to appreciate some of the ripple effects in the other worlds. So the dangers of this stovepiping, this disconnect, they're diverse. Each of us, in whatever role we play in life, again, whether in our professional role, in our business, or our organization, our role as citizens and what we think about political topics to how to protect ourselves and our family online. We all make decisions, cybersecurity decisions, that shape both the future of the online world and us in it, but also the real world. But we often do so without proper tools, basic terms and essential concepts that define both what's possible, but even more so what's proper, what's right and wrong. They're being missed, or even worse, distorted. Past myth and future hype often weave together, obscuring what actually happened with where we are right now in reality with where we're headed to next. So you have some threats that are overblown and overreacted to, and other real threats that are ignored. So, for example, I'm someone who loves history, and it absolutely pains me when I hear, and this has been done by everything from senators to White House officials to generals to prominent news columnists, say things like, cyber weapons are just like a WMD, and this is just like the Cold War. This is a cyber Cold War. You see those terminologies all the time. If you know both your history and your cyber side, you quickly realize that the parallel is not the one that they think they're making. If there's any parallel to the Cold War period, it's the early days when we didn't well understand the technology itself, but even more so the political dynamics that it was driving, and that period of history when we took the real-world versions of Dr. Strangelove seriously. That's the better parallel to today. So what are some of the manifestations that come out of this? One is that we too often lump together unlike things simply because they involve zeros and ones, because they involve the Internet. For example, the lead U.S. general who's in command of both the military's cyber command and simultaneously wearing the hat as director of the NSA, which we would not see happen in other fields, but somehow we think it's okay here. He testified to Congress, quote, "Every day, America's armed forces face millions of cyber attacks," end quote. But to get those numbers, he was combining everything from unmotivated probes and address scans that never even tried to enter networks, to attempts to carry out pranks, to attempts to carry out political protests, to attempts to carry out economic espionage, diplomatic espionage, national security espionage, all together. But none of those millions of attacks were what his audience in that congressional briefing room and in the wider body politic thought when he said it, the so-called attempts at a digital Pearl Harbor or cyber 9/11. These are things, for example, digital Pearl Harbor and cyber 9/11 have not only been used in a series of major government speeches, but then have been reported in the media over 500,000 times. So essentially what happens when people are talking about cyber attacks is they're bundling together all of these various things simply because they involve the Internet and its related technology. The parallel would be a lot like saying a group of teenagers with firecrackers, political protesters in the street with a smoke bomb, a terrorist with a roadside bomb, James Bond with his Walter PPK pistol, and a Russian cruise missile. Well, these are all one and the same because they involve the technology, the chemistry of gunpowder, right? Of course not. We would never do that. But somehow it's acceptable in this space. The organizations. I, for example, had a senior U.S. military official argue with me that Anonymous and Al-Qaeda were the same thing. Now, wherever you stand on Anonymous, and I've figured out that I'm probably more empathetic towards them than pretty much anyone in the D.C. security establishment, but the bottom line is, wherever you stand on them, they differ from Al-Qaeda in everything from their organization, their personnel, their profile, their means, their ends. Pretty much the only thing they share is they're both non-state actors that begin with the letter A. So to put them together is just nonsensical, again, whether you support them or you're trying to come up with a strategy against them. Now, these gaps in understanding, these disconnects of policy, reality, and technology mean that we're not only seeing growing tension, it's one of the things that's feeding into poisoning the U.S.-China relationship, but it also means that we're being taken advantage of. We're taken advantage of at the individual level by that email you received from your mom saying, I'm stuck in Iceland, can you send me your bank account information? You go, oh, goodness, I didn't know mom was in Iceland, but I better help her. We smile, we laugh about that, but this hits even the most senior people. A group of diplomats at the G20 conference, the most important international conference of the year, received what's known as a spear phishing email. It gave them an exciting offer. It said, if you click this link, you'll be able to see nude photos of the former French First Lady. Great offer. Many of them clicked the link, and instead of getting the nude photos, downloaded spyware from an espionage agency into their computers. Or being taken advantage of at the organizational level, at the business level, or the university level, or the like. Alternatively, not doing enough to protect ourselves, or hiring hucksters who promise 100% security through some kind of silver bullet solution. Or frankly, we're being taken advantage of at the national political level, which is, I think, behind a number of the issues that played out with the Snowden NSA revelations. This can even happen to a president. Reportedly, Obama expressed his, quote, frustration that the complexity of the technology was overwhelming policymakers. Now, our inability to have a proper discussion about all of this not only can create a distortion of threats, but even more so a misapplication of resources. Maybe the best illustration is another number, 31,300. That's the number of academic journal and magazine and press articles that have focused on the phenomena of cyber terrorism. Zero. That's the number of people who have actually been hurt or killed by a real incident of cyber terrorism. I joke that cyber terrorism is a lot like Discovery Channel Shark Week, where we obsess about the danger of sharks, even though you're 15,000 times more likely to be hurt on your toilet. Except the difference is while Jaws was fictional, people actually have been hurt by sharks. Now, let me be 100% clear here. I'm not saying that terrorists don't use the Internet. There's several chapters in the book about how they use the Internet, which is actually like much of the way the rest of us use the Internet. I'm also not saying that there is not the possibility, and even more so the likelihood, of cyber terrorism in the future with real-world impact, as, for example, Stuxnet, the first cyber weapon revealed. But that very same story shows how it's not the way it's too often depicted, where, you know, whether it's the Die Hard 4 scenario of we just have to break into this plan and all the power in the U.S. will go down, or it's the way, for example, a former U.S. military official talked about how a couple, and this was his description, a couple of teenagers sitting in their parents' basement wearing flip-flops, sipping Red Bull, could carry out a WMD-style attack. No. As Stuxnet reveals, one, there's danger here, but it also requires to carry out something at that high operational level, a wide, deep set of expertise. So Stuxnet involved not just some of the top cyber expertise in the world, but also everything from intelligence analysis and collection to expertise in fields that range from engineering to nuclear physics. That's not something that a couple of teens sipping Red Bull you get. You know, Red Bull gives you wings, but not that. My point here is, to put it a different way, is if you want to sum it up, Al-Qaeda would like to, but it can't. China could, but it doesn't want to, for both of them, yet. What I'm trying to say is, at a larger level of strategy, whether it's national political strategy, business strategy, or your individual strategy, it's always about choices, priorities. And so we need to weigh the centrality of what we talk about, what we obsess about, what we focus on, versus what's real and arguably greater threats out there. So, for example, while squirrels have taken down power grids more times than the zero times that hackers have, again, doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but I'm talking about it in terms of the real term, the fictionalized scenario versus the real largest theft in all of human history that's happening right now. The massive campaign of intellectual property theft going back to China that involves both an economic security impact, by one measure over $1 trillion worth of value lost, to a national security impact, some of the key jewels of the crown in defense technology lost, maybe a decade's worth of advantage lost on a potential future battlefield. So what I'm getting at is that these may not be as sexy as a cyber 9/11, cyber Pearl Harbor discourse, equally if you're talking about how the military uses it. The military definitely plays in this realm, and let's focus on the reality of computer network operations versus, again, the Hollywoodized scenarios. But it's also, just as we've learned from regular terrorism, it's not merely about the direct impact of something, it's about the ripple effects, and even more so, your own actions in response can determine the true story of how it plays out. One that deeply worries me is how this critical value to the Internet itself, trust, is being damaged, being hollowed out. It's being damaged by the massive campaigns of cybercrime that's out there, but it's also being damaged by other actions in response to threats. So, for example, a fear over traditional terrorism led to a metadata collection program that has been a hammer blow not only to America's national standing and our relationship with our allies, but also been a hammer blow to American technology companies. By one report, Forrester, they estimated over $180 billion worth of revenue will be lost because of this. Or to the impact on the growing attempts by certain authoritarian governments around the world, most particularly Russia and China, to push for a more state-controlled Internet governance model. And what does this mean for the future? What I'm getting at here is that this value of trust that has allowed the Internet to run successfully, but to become, I would argue, the greatest force for political, social, economic change, not just in my lifetime, but maybe in all of history, it's being threatened. The Internet that I grew to know and love, that you all grew up with, may not be the one that my sons inherit, and that scares me. Now, this gap in the fields, these disconnects, also mean that sometimes we act on bad assumptions or don't make connections across domains in ways that truly matter. So take, for example, the discourse over offense and defense in international security circles versus cybersecurity circles. A notion has taken hold that cyber offense is inherently privileged against the defense. And in fact, the U.S. military report said that it's not just at an advantage, but it will be so, quote, for the foreseeable future. For as long as we can look out in the future, cyber offense will dominate against cyber defense, so goes the argument. And this, in turn, has led the U.S. military to spend, again, depending on the measure, 2.5 to 4 times as much on cyber offense research and development as cyber defense research and development. But there's three problems with this. The first is, as I referenced before, cyber offense is not as easy as it's too often depicted. You need more than that can of Red Bull, particularly to do an actual campaign, not just one attack. And the defense, in turn, is not lying there helpless. There's a series of things that they can do, and it also carries out in stages. It's not so simple as it's too often portrayed in bumper sticker discussions. Second, if you go to military history, pretty much every time a military assumed that the offense would dominate because of some new technology, they would get a wake-up call. We're actually at the 100-year anniversary of maybe the biggest of these in all of history. If you look back at the European armies in 1914, every single one of them thought, because of the new technologies of the day, the offense was dominant. And in fact, they feared being stuck on the defense so much that they urged their governments that if there's any point of crisis, we got to be the first to go because we don't want to be stuck on the defense. And that was one of the forces that helped spark World War I. And they turned out to be wrong. Actually, the offense wasn't so dominant. The third issue is you can think about it in terms of a metaphor, and it illustrates the difference between applying some kind of Cold War binary political framework deterrent structure to a more complex cyber world. If you are standing in a glass house and you're worried about more than 100 different everything from gangs of teenagers to military attack or the like, the best way to secure yourself is not to say, you know what I really need to buy? A stone sharpening kit. That will solve my problems. So what can we do? The last third of the book is all the what can we do kind of questions, everything from what can we do at the global level to the national level to the business organizational level down to what can we do at an individual level to secure ourselves and help secure the Internet. And so I'm not going to try and summarize 100 pages. What I'll try and do is identify what I think are key themes that carry through all of this. The first is knowledge matters. It is absolutely vital that we demystify this realm if we ever want to get anything done effective in securing it. We have to move past the situation which we're in right now where, for example, the President of the United States received a briefing on cyber issues and then asked for it repeated back, quote, this time in English. That's not to knock President Obama. That same thing would happen at pretty much every major corporation, every university, and most households. We have to move past thinking that this is solely for the it crowd, or as another White House official put it to me, it's the, quote, domain for the nerds. No, it's for all of us, because we're all of us online. The second is, it's on that us aspect. People matter. Cybersecurity is one of those, what they call, wicked problem areas because of all the trade-offs and complexities. And this is in large part not because of the technical side, but because of the people side. Now, the people side makes it really useful from a writer's perspective because you can tell cool stories, you know, everything from the role of porn in the history of the Internet and cybersecurity to the episode where Pakistan accidentally kidnapped all the world's cute cat videos for a day. Great stories, but what it also means is if you're trying to set up responses at a global level, at a business level, et cetera, you have to recognize that the people behind the machines are inherently part of every threat, and every response. This leads to the third, incentives matter. If you want to understand why something is or isn't happening in cybersecurity, look to the motivations, look to the relative costs, look to the tensions at play in the issue. There is a reason why finance companies are doing better not only at their own cybersecurity, but also in sharing information with others about it than, for example, power companies. It's because they're incentivized to understand both the costs and the consequences in a very different way. This also points to the role that government can and should be playing in this space. In some situations, as a trusted information provider, a researcher, a resource, and in other situations, like it's done in a wide variety of marketplaces, it has to help change some of the incentive structures out there. Fourth point, history matters. There is a history to how we got here with the Internet, and understanding that is key, especially when you hear, you know, silly ideas that have been expressed in, again, some serious places, like, well, we need a new, more secure Internet. Let's just build that instead. My joke in the book is the idea of rebooting the Internet makes as much sense as rebooting Beverly Hills 90210. It's a bad idea. It never should have happened. It will act like it didn't happen. The point is not just that we need to know our Internet history and how it shapes the online world and the world beyond, but also that we can learn from other histories beyond. So, for example, if we're wrestling with what do we deal with individual criminal groups and quasi-state-link groups in a domain of commerce, communication, and conflict, we can actually look back for inspiration from, for example, the Age of Sail and how they dealt with a different kind of pirate and privateers back then. Or, for example, if we're thinking about what government action is needed, let's look at the instances of the most successful government agencies out there. We look at the case of the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, which starts with literally members of it taking a $10 collection, $10 in total in donation. And that agency goes on to do everything from eradicate malaria inside the United States, at the global level, the smallpox campaign, to serve as a crucial back channel to the Soviets during the Cold War. This leads to the fifth and final point. Ben Franklin had his saying that, quote, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The CDC did studies that found that Franklin's idea actually does hold true when you test it out in public health. Prevention is really the best place to put your resources into it. And it goes a long way. It's the same thing in cybersecurity. Despite all of the attempts to complexify this space, to turn the fear factor up, you know, Spinal Tap volume style, to frame it as something where you need a man on cyber horseback to come in and save you, whether it's a man in uniform or a man in a cybersecurity company, the reality is that very basic steps of cyber hygiene would go an incredibly long way. For example, one study found that the simple measures, the top 10 and then top 20 controls, would stop up to 94% of all cyber attacks. Now, people respond to that, and sometimes they say, well, I'm really special. I'm in the 6%. The first is statistically, we can't all be in the 6%. The second is talk to your IT department. If they didn't have to spend so much time running down the low-level stuff, they could focus in on the high-end stuff. Finally, the reality is many of the toughest challenges, the most advanced threats, still use very basic steps to get in that would be stopped by cyber hygiene. For example, the most important outside foreign spy agency penetration of classified U.S. military networks happened when a U.S. soldier found a memory stick on the ground in a parking lot and thought it was a good idea to pick up the memory stick, take it inside to the base, and plug it into his computer to see what was on it. That's not just cyber hygiene. That's basic hygiene. That's the 5-second rule. This idea of hygiene, though, is important, not just because of the lessons and the idea of, you know, prevention going a long way, but also the ethic that we need to build about our collective responsibility. Again, at the global level, the national level, the organizational level, down to the individual level. We teach our kids the basics of hygiene and things like cover your mouth when you cough. We teach it not just to protect themselves, but also to give them an ethic of they're responsible for protecting everyone else they come into contact with during their day. That's the same kind of ethic we need to be building in cyberspace, and that's the only way we'll get to a greater sense of actual cybersecurity. So to bring this story full circle, at the beginning of the talk, I explained how, you know, I was first introduced to computers as a young kid. Now, if you had said to my 7-year-old self, one day this machine will allow bad guys to steal money from people, steal their identity, maybe be a weapon of mass disruption, I would have begged and pleaded with my dad not to turn on that big power button. Don't do it. Today we wouldn't have it any other way. Because this same machine and the world it's created has given all of us what back then we would have thought of as superpowers. The idea that you could run down the answer to any question that you might have. The idea that you could communicate, you could talk, you could see with someone a world away. That you could even become friends with someone that you literally never met before. Those would have been viewed as superpowers back then. Today we take them for granted. And so my point is that the same as it was back then is the way it is now and where I think it should be in the future. We have to accept and manage the risks of the online world and the real world because of all that can be achieved in it. And to steal a line from the title of the book, that's really what everyone needs to know. Thank you. I think we've got some time for questions or comments. I believe the protocol is to ask folks to come up over here to the mic. Or, no, go ahead and just stand up, introduce, raise your hand, I'll call you, stand up, introduce yourself, and try to present them. Any questions or comments at all? Yeah, right there.
My question is, what about what is called the Internet of Things, which means that I have to watch out for somebody hijacking my refrigerator, my thermostat, or something like that? And how does that tie into your idea of hygiene?
So a couple of things here. One, the Internet of Things is one of those key trends, much like mobile or changing nationality makeup of Internet users, that's truly going to reshape the Internet itself and how we use the Internet. And it offers incredible possibilities in ways that will benefit the world. So the way, you know, I'll illustrate it with, you know, the classic example is right now, if you bought a new car, it automatically will communicate to the manufacturer when some part needs to be replaced, and some will even go ahead and make that appointment for you at the dealership. The next stage of this is a lot like the history of the Internet itself, when you take this kind of semi-closed network and connect it across. So your car communicates to your thermostat that you're 10 minutes away, and your thermostat, which has been on the most efficient setting for this, because it's connected to the smart power grid, will shift to where you like it. The problem, what you're getting at, is that we're already seeing risks woven into this. We've already seen car hacking, where people, you know, your car is literally filled with hundreds of computers. We've already seen people cause computers to do things other than what the driver wants to. It truly, if we're looking at this from the cyber war side, this is where we move from thinking about this and ways, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's been called cyber war that's not, you know, disruptions and the like. It's the combination of what I mentioned before, new weapons like Stuxnet, but also new targets like the Internet of Things that give it a much greater impact. So now you're able to design a weapon that its intent is not just to steal information or jam it, but actually to co-opt the system and cause it to do something physically different. So Stuxnet, for example, caused the Iranian nuclear research centrifuges not just merely to damage what they were working on, but also to spin out of control and even damage themselves, et cetera. So now you're talking about adding this into the world of the civilian side. To link to the prior book that John mentioned that I did, this is where drones and robotics connects back to cyber and a whole new phase of war. Because when you don't have the human inside the weapon system, where they're either remotely operating it or it's autonomous or semi-autonomous or whatnot, you move from battles being about destruction, destroy enemy tank, to what I call battles of persuasion, co-opt the tank. If you can get access, which a cyber attack is about gaining access, then you can cause that tank, that drone, whatnot, to do something other than what its owner wants to. And this is, you know, something we've never seen before in war. You've never been able to take the arrow in mid-flight and make it go.
Well, he has about 20 more minutes of questions that he answers there at the Stevens Institute. I'd highly recommend that you listen to that. You can go to cspan.org and on recent appearances, and it's also going to be aired again on Book TV on Sunday, March 2nd at 5:15 p.m. Well, that's it. That's it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We thank you very much for joining us. And what we'll do is have Vera Lim say goodbye, as she usually does.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.